In the year of 1798, sorrowful tale, the truth unto you I'll relate. 36 heroes to the war they were left to be seen. By false information, they were shot on Dunlavin Green.
Dunlavin Green, the evocative ballad that recalls the execution of 36 rebels in a small Wicklow town in May 1798, sung there beautifully by Karen Casey. The 1798 United Irishmen Rebellion was inspired by the egalitarian ideals that flowed from both the American and the French revolutions. The tragic events of 98 and the subsequent rising in 1803 gave rise to a huge canon of songs like Dunlavin Green. History, they say, is written by the victors, but these songs come from the defeated and put their voices back into the record. I'm Therese McIntyre, and in this episode, I'm exploring the hero songs from the Age of Rebellion, including those of executed United Irishmen, such as Belfast man Henry Joy McCracken.
Since Henry Joy McCracken died on the gallows tree.
Sean Doyle there singing Henry Joy McCracken. And one of Ireland's most romanticised rebel leaders, the young Dublin aristocrat Robert Emmet, who fled to France after the rebellion, but later returned to lead the 1803 uprising, and who eventually paid with his life. A story which the song The Bold Robert Emmet relates.
We were defeated and shamefully treated, and I, Robert Emmet, awaiting my doom.
That was Patsy Watchorn's version of The Bold Robert Emmet, and we'll be hearing more about that song later on in the programme. But what was the spirit of 1798, and why did it inspire such a range of songs? Many of which, like The Minstrel Boy, written by Thomas Moore and recorded here by John McCormack, are sung worldwide even today.
The minstrel fell, but the foeman's chain could not bring that proud soul under.
Defining Irishness rather than simply remembering 1798. So what is the story behind these songs? I went to talk to history lecturer Maura Cronin at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick to find out more.
The original songs from 1798, we really don't know who composed them, but they seem to have come from below. And certainly the Father Murphy of County Wexford songs, they seem to have come from very, very close to the rebellion itself. We know that from their familiarity with place names, often place names which outsiders wouldn't know.
Then Father Murphy from Mull Kilkarma spurred up the rock to warning cry.
The songs that were written later, 100 years later or so, these are written by identifiable individuals, P.J. McCall, for example. So their purpose is political. Their purpose is entertainment as well, because there's nothing like a good song. And they're built to airs which are already familiar, especially those by P.J. McCall.
You'll fight or die.
Now, Maura, do you think there's a difference between songs like Dunlavin Green, which were written at the time, and those like Boule Vogue or The Bold Robert Emmet, written 100 years later?
I think the 1798 songs are probably more accurate. I think that especially songs that are composed locally do seem to string together events that actually happened. Now, maybe not in the right sequence and maybe in a very biased way, but I think we're getting a kind of a newsreel of a series of events. I think the failed leaders are heroes precisely because they failed. The version of reality that's in the songs is they failed heroically. And they rose against insurmountable odds. Yes, they were defeated. But I think the very important thing there is that they will come again. No, not so much that they will come again physically. So I think actually the failure is essential to being a hero.
Or the pleasant
back to back on the oars of Tullow took Father Murphy and they burned his body upon.
So if, as Maura says, failure makes the hero, I asked Professor Kevin Whelan, author of The Tree of Liberty, about the mood of the era and why so many of the United Irishmen, including Wolfe Tone, Henry Joy McCracken and Robert Emmet, came from wealthy Protestant backgrounds.
These young men were Republicans. They were following in the footsteps of the French Revolution, the American Revolution. And there was a sense in the 1790s of a kind of a possibility, an openness, a kind of a retreat from the old verities of sectarianism and relatively narrow kind of social setup.
In the year of 1790.
These songs are important not just in the song tradition, but as a window into how people felt and thought and into the kind of popular culture of the period.
Of 36 heroes, into the world they were left to be seen by a false information. They were shot on Dunlavin Green.
The song Dunlavin Green, as sung there by the great Christy Moore, is perhaps one of the most popular rebel ballads of the period and has been recorded many times. That May, the mass execution of 36 Wicklow rebels took place, mostly local men who had joined the United Irishmen. The song is narrated from the point of view of an eyewitness. Here's Kevin Whelan again.
It's one of the brilliant songs of 1798, really, because it comes out of the people themselves. It's an anonymous song. We don't know who wrote it. It's written with English words, but to an Irish air, a haunting Irish air, as many of these songs are. What makes the song really powerful is that it has so many place names in it. It has so many names in it.
Why is the two Duffies who were shot down on the plain? And young Matty Farrell, whose mother distracted, will run for the loss of her own darling by her eldest son. Bad luck to you, Saunders, bad luck may you never show.
And it has this powerful sense of the curse on the oppressive landlord, Morley Saunders of Saunders Grove. God's curse on you, Saunders, God's curse may you never shun, that the widow's curse may melt you like snow before sun. It's powerful stuff.
Those orphans, those murmurs you will never scream, for the loss of their own poor fathers who died on the green.
It's very visual, very powerful, very emotional, and it commemorates this horrific event that occurred on Dunlavin Green, where the prisoners in Dunlavin were taken out under conditions of panic, really, when the rebellion had broken out and when the news of this was spreading from Dublin down towards Wicklow, that these guys were just taken out without trial, without court-martial, without anything else, and just shot on Dunlavin Green in conditions of great brutality. And it was the very fact that this was so excessive, so outlandish, so outside the normal experience, that it kind of burned its way into the folk memory and then produced this hugely haunting and powerful song, which has lasted in the repertoire for over 200 years simply because it presents such a vivid and evocative description. You know, seeing your sons, your lovers, your boyfriends, your brother, your neighbour, your schoolmate, your political companion, your hurling mate, being shot.
Kevin Whelan. I'm with Gerry O'Reilly now. Gerry, you're a singer with the Gaeilge Traditional Singers Club, and you know this song and the story behind it very well. How true is it to the actual events?
In the year of 1798, a most sorrowful story, the truth to you I will relate, of 36 heroes to the world were left to be seen, who by false information were shot on Dunlavin Green.
By a false information they were shot on Dunlavin Green.
The information wasn't false. The information was true. They had sworn the oath, and that was enough. None of them had taken place in any rebellion. The only thing they had done, they had sworn the oath of allegiance to the Society of the United Irishmen.
When do you think the song was written, and any idea who might have been the composer?
It has never been documented, but the local tradition has it that it was written by the local priest at the time, and he died in December 1799 at 34 years of age. Father Philip Byrne was his name.
Surrounded we were and privately marched away.
It was printed on broadsheets and disseminated in that way. And that's the way songs were disseminated in those days.
Like prisoners through the town.
Now, Jerry, the version of the song we're hearing is that of the late Frank Hart. Now, you knew Frank for years. What's the story behind this recording?
Frank recorded that for the First Year of Liberty, the CD that he released in 1998 to mark the 200th anniversary of 1798. And it's a fantastic recording, himself with Donal Lunny. And if you listen to the recording, Donal is playing the same chord all the way through. He doesn't change. And in effect, that's like a toll bell tolling for the debts. And that was the effect that Frank was trying to achieve.
There is young Matty Farrell has plenty of cause to complain.
That was the haunting melody of Dunlavin Green with the voice of the late Frank Hart. The roots of the rebellion were actually in Belfast, where the Society of United Irishmen was founded in 1791 by several Protestant liberals. And I'm here now in Belfast with Kevin Whelan to talk about one of those leaders, Antrim man Henry Joy McCracken.
We're here in High Street in Belfast under the plaque for Henry Joy McCracken. And as the name might suggest, the Joys and the McCrackens were two of the principal mercantile families in Belfast. So the very unusual thing about Henry Joy McCracken is that he came, a little bit like Robert Emmet, he came not from the poor or the impoverished, but from the very wealthiest echelons of Belfast Presbyterian mercantile life. And that was unusual. So, you know, and Henry John McCracken as well had the kind of outreach, as we would now say, an outreach towards the kind of poor. He famously said, the rich will always betray the poor. And so, you know, he paid with his life precisely because he chose against his class, against his background or whatever. But in the same way, people who kind of do that because it's so unusual do enter the kind of folk memory. And it is striking that in the songs of the 1798 period, which came out of the Ulster Rising, that Henry Joy figures prominently. So the United Irishmen in Belfast went through two phases, the earlier phase, which was the open phase, and then from 1795 they went kind of underground and became a revolutionary organisation committed to a forcible overthrow of the existing regime, if possible on their own, but if necessary with the support of France. And Henry Joy McCracken was one of the young men who, with Theobald Wolfetone and others on the Cavehill Mountain overlooking Belfast, set up that new phase of the United Irishmen in 1795. But McCracken, unlike many of his comrades who had been involved in the movement earlier, didn't kind of wilt or disappear when the pressure came on, as it did in Belfast very strongly in 1797 and 1798. Now, in Belfast, many of the younger 20-year-olds were very interested in the United Irishmen, but it was unusual for somebody to make the supreme commitment that Henry Joy McCracken did. And I think, in fact, that's why he became a kind of a hero and why he is actually remembered in many of the songs of the period.
An Ulster man, I'm proud to be from the Antrim clans I come.
When the call came to take to arms in 1798, he was really one of the very, very few of the senior leaders of the early phase of the United Irishmen who had kind of stuck with it right the way through. And again, I think that was what people admired in him, that this was somebody who, when the going got tough, was still there and right to the bitter, and in his case to a lethal end.
I followed Henry Joy.
He was executed in just after the rebellion, once they actually found him up on the mountains over looking Belfast. Again, because of his family connections or whatever, maybe he wasn't treated as roughly as some of them kind of were, but it was kind of like a show execution, and it was deliberately saying to Belfast, look, here's one of your, you know, gilded youths who took a wrong kind of turn, and we're hanging him to show you this is not going to be tolerated, and don't anybody else follow his example. So it was a deliberate exercise in kind of state terror. in the sense of staging the execution publicly on the street with many, many people kind of looking at it, because executions were almost a form of entertainment at that stage. You know, and McCracken then, obviously with his beloved sister, Mary Ann McCracken, who's an admirable figure in her own right, but Mary Ann was there then to take care of the body.
He kissed his sister, went all over, and waved his last goodbye. Oh God, I cried, I turned and I sighed, they have murdered Henry.
It was very important to McCracken and to the United Irishmen that he died in the 18th century term staunch. He didn't show cowardice on the actual scaffold.
Now there's two songs about Henry Joe McCracken. The one you just heard there by Terry O'Neill, "An Ulster Man I'm Proud to Be from the Antrim Glens I Come," is told from the point of view of a McCracken follower. However, there's a lesser known song about McCracken known as "The Belfast Mountain," which is more of a love song.
It was on the Belfast mountains I heard a maid complain, and she vexed the sweet June evening with her heartbroken strain, saying, "Woe is me, life's anguish is more than I can dree, since Henry Joy McCracken died on the gallows tree."
I asked music scholar Dr. John Molden about it.
Henry Joy McCracken was written in 1896 and founded on an older song, which is among the songs in P.J. McCall's collection of ballad sheets, a song which was widely published on ballad sheets in both Britain and Ireland, and is called "The Belfast Mountains." So it's inevitable that "it was on the Belfast Mountains I heard a maid complain" is among the first lines of this song. But P.J. McCall published it first in a magazine, the first issue of January 1896, of a magazine called Shan Van Vocht.
"And is it true?" I asked her. "Yes, it is true," she said. "For to this heart that loved him, I pressed his gory head. And every night, pale bleeding, his ghost comes to my side, and Harry, my dead Harry, comes for his promised bride."
It classes him as a hero mainly because the girl in the song, who is identified, of course, in most people's minds, though she is never named, as Mary Bodell, who had been McCracken's lover and bore a daughter. He is a hero because he is cast as a hero by her telling of the story. He's a hero because he was betrayed. And he is, of course, a hero because we cast everybody who was involved in the 1798 rebellion as a hero.
"Shrieks freedom above his weary head."
That was Rosie Stewart there with a moving version of Henry Joy McCracken.
"The struggle is over and the boys..."
I'm in Dublin in St. Stephen's Green before the statue of Robert Emmet, and I'm curious if people today actually know who he was.
I remember studying him in primary school. Like, I think like it's something to do with the flight of the Earls. I know he represents Ireland in a big way.
The statue is of Robert Emmet, who fought for Ireland, and he died in 1803.
No, don't know anything about him.
He was hanged up in Thomas Street.
I didn't learn about him in school, but my nanny was telling me. We're around Thomas Street and she showed us where he was actually hung.
I know of him because there's a Robert Emmet Theatre in Trinity, so that's where I know the name.
I'm not related to him, but my cousin is on my nanny's side.
Freedom fighter. He's looking green and black right now, but I'm sure he had a lot more colour back in the day.
I'm with historian Patrick Gagan, who's written a biography of Robert Emmet. Now, Patrick, Emmet's story essentially has everything needed to make a romantic hero. He was young, brilliant, wealthy, which is the image portrayed by the song Bold Robert Emmet. I know he was at Trinity when he was just 15, and that's where he got involved in the United Irishmen. But how did such a young man end up a leader in 1803?
Yeah, he was expelled in April 1798 along with 18 other students because of his role in the United Irishmen. The rebellion broke out that summer, it was crushed, he didn't see any fighting in Dublin, but because in the wake of that rebellion all of the leaders were either dead or in exile, he suddenly found himself at the age of 20, one of the new leaders of the United Irishmen, and he was put in charge of a committee to try and find out what had gone wrong. And what he discovered was that too many people had known the plan in advance, so he decided that any future plan would have to rely on secrecy. Emmet was hoping to break the connection between Ireland and Britain and establish an independent Irish Republic. He wasn't motivated by any hostility towards Britain. He admired Britain as a country, but he believed that Ireland should be independent, and he believed that Catholics should be given full rights in an Irish state. The rebellion was set for the 23rd of July 1803. The government was caught completely by surprise, but Emmet was expecting 1,000 men. He only got 80 men, and most of them were drunk. Emmet only got as far as Patrick Street. He saw that it wasn't going well and decided to cancel the whole thing. The men carried on fighting, and Lord Kilwarden, the Lord Chief Justice, was murdered. Emmet escaped to the Wicklow Mountains, but then he came back to Dublin, and it's always been said that he did it to be near his girlfriend Sarah Curran. I don't think that's really the case. I think he wanted to protect the other rebels and ensure that they escaped to safety. So he came back, rented a house at Harold's Cross that was raided by the police at the end of August, and Emmet was captured.
Emmet's capture and execution is perhaps how many remember his story. He sought refuge with his lover Sarah Curran, and his housekeeper Anne Devlin refused to betray him in spite of being tortured. But it's his speech from the dock that defined Emmet as a true hero.
Emmet was put on trial on the 19th of September 1803. The jury didn't need to retire from its box to consider its verdict. After about 30 seconds, it returned a verdict of guilty. The judge then asked Emmet what he had to say, why sentence of death should not be pronounced upon him. And it's that point that he delivered the speech that has been proved so influential. And I think what's worth bearing in mind about the speech is that Emmet had been left standing for the entire duration of the trial, about 11 hours. He had had no break for food or water. So he was exhausted physically. He was broken emotionally. He knew he had lost everything, and he knew he was going to be hanged and beheaded the very next day. And yet he found the strength from somewhere to deliver that brilliant speech from the dock, a speech that was memorized in its entirety by a young Abraham Lincoln.
I have one request to make. Let there be no inscription upon my tomb. Let no man write my epitaph. No man can write my epitaph.
The day after the oration on September 20th, 1803, Emmet was brought to Thomas Street for a public execution. Terry Moylan, author of The Age of Revolution in the Irish Song Tradition, took me on a tour.
The struggle is over, the boys are defeated.
I think in Emmet's time, Thomas Street would have been a middle-class area. Occupied mostly by traders, grocers, publicans. There were several breweries and distilleries along the stretch, so it would have been a kind of a commercial street. Emmet was executed here because this is where the significant crime, the murder of Lord Kilwarden, was committed. It was the custom to hang people at the site of their crime at the time. Famously, the hangman, Galvin, is supposed to have said, "Behold the head of a traitor."
And the hero I'll die, Bold Robert Emmet.
That's Jerry O'Reilly's version of the Bold Robert Emmet. The song itself first appeared on a broadsheet nearly 100 years after Emmet's execution, and it's sung to the air of an old English folk song. I asked Patrick Gagan, how accurate is it?
I think in a way the song's reflect a certain truth about the story and also contribute to the myth-making. For example, Bold Robert Emmet has Emmet being hung, drawn and quartered. That was his sentence. Well, he wasn't hung, drawn and quartered because although that would have been the original sentence, it was always commuted to hanging and then beheading. So if you ask most people now, how did Emmet die? They will always say he was hung, drawn and quartered, which is something that they know from the song rather than from the history. So although that said, I think the ballad captured, I suppose, the essential truth of the man and his rebellion, the heroism, the defiance with which he faced death on the scaffold, the tragedy of his life. So in that sense, it does capture a broader truth.
We don't actually know who the composer of the Bold Robert Emmet is, but it's been covered by many artists, including Derek Warfield, one of the founding members of the Wolf Tones. But he first got to know the tune as the Bard of Armagh.
A poor Irish harper.
But it's an air you may know also as the American ballad The Streets of Laredo.
There was an old song called The Bard of Armagh, and I remember my grandmother used to sing it, and that's the tune that Robert Emmet's song was written to. I remember going to America and hearing it sung as a cowboy song. Of course, the thing that struck me when I went to America first, like, Emmet was remembered everywhere. I suppose I loved the song and I liked the person.
Bold Robert Emmet, the darling of Erin. Bold Robert.
That's Derek Warfield's version there, but Kevin Whelan is no fan of the song.
Bold Robert Emmet, the darling of Erin, was a kind of a camellia. It was kind of, you know, one of these songs that people sung, but to my way of looking, it doesn't really have a huge amount of resonance or kind of depth to it, except insofar that it shows you what the popular version of Robert Emmet had become by the second half of the 19th century. So in other words, a song like Bold Robert Emmet tells you absolutely zip about Robert Emmet, but it tells you everything about what way Irish nationalists thought in the 1870s and 1880s.
And I have no friends here.
Next week, I'll be exploring the hero songs of lost leaders, from Charles Stuart Parnell to Bonnie Prince Charlie, and one who declined to help Robert Emmet, the little corporal Napoleon Bonaparte.
Attention, pay both young and old to these few lines that I'll unfold. It is the deeds of great Napoleon I'm going to relate.